Welcome to Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunanada. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. Our guest today is Larry Amick Smallwood, who grew up in Ajimoud, the Lake Lena district of Mille Lacs. He has worked as a language instructor for the Minneapolis Public Schools, Neosing School, the Leech Lake Tribal College, and the University of Minnesota Duluth. Since 1999, he has served as the Director of Language and Culture for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. Today we talk about approaching elders and the role of traditional ceremonies in our communities. So it's the time of year where we're having ceremonies, and I was just wondering, what were your thoughts on the protocol for approaching an elder, if you wanted something like a naming ceremony or other type of ceremony, if you wanted an elder to come and perform that for you?
That's a good question, because so many times people need to have something done for their families or themselves, and they don't know what to do, but they know there are people out there that can do these things, so... You know, they always say, well, what should I do? How do I do this? I don't want to bother him, this and that. Well, you know, years ago in our communities, there were several people in that community that could do certain things, you know, naming ceremonies, sweats, feasts, and funerals. Now it's they're kind of far and few between. But it depends also on what kind of a ceremony that you want them to do. It used to be that you would go to that individual's house with tobacco and say, could you come over on a such and such date, come over and do a naming ceremony for our child. And they would pick a date, and the person doing that would go there that day. But it's always tobacco first. Tobacco is the number one item that you give when you want spiritual help.
And what kind of tobacco are we talking? Is it tobacco ties? Is it loose pipe tobacco? Is it a pack of cigarettes? Any of the above?
We don't use tobacco ties except for one time, and we put it on our kettle during Medewin. But usually you go over there with some loose tobacco. A lot of times people will bring me tobacco, and I'll take a pinch of that for them. And then I have this big box of tobacco laying around, so... Myself, I prefer you come over and give me a cigarette. Well, I am a smoker, but, you know, and it's the same thing. I'll use that cigarette to do my offering. But, yeah, you take tobacco over to the individual and ask them to come over on such and such date for such as a naming, and that individual will agree. Same thing goes if you want somebody to do a funeral ceremony. You go to that individual's house and you tell him what has happened, and a lot of times he'll smoke his pipe there and do a prayer for you, and then give you some instructions as how to do, how he wants to do it. And you know, when you ask somebody to do a ceremony for you, respect that man or that woman's way of doing the ceremony. You see, a lot of times people ask somebody to go do something, a naming ceremony or a funeral or something, and they will sit there and they'll say, well, we do it this way. Well, we do it that way. Well, fine, you know, you do it that way. But I was given a way. I was taught. And you have to respect my ways. So keep in mind to respect that individual's ways that you had come over to do this naming ceremony or this funeral. And don't try to get him to change the way he was taught.
Micromanage.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Take Mr. Staples, for example. If you go and ask him to do a funeral, well, he has his way of that. He was taught, and that respect the way that he's going to do this. So many times we're asked to go do a ceremony somewhere, and during the funeral services, our people are not allowed to wear their glasses when they come up to view the deceased. And it's a cultural teaching. There's a glare there. And that is why some of the people cover up all the windows and all the mirrors and stuff in their houses. Well, we go to some places there and they get pretty upset. Well, I can't see him. I want to see my cousin over here. I don't know what he looks like. I can't see without my glasses. And they get mad, you know. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't do that. Respect the teachings and don't challenge the teachings. And doing the funerals, you know, we don't mix any Christianity during our funerals, during our services. That's just like saying your way is not good enough. We're going to bring in this way too, you know. So, well, don't ask us to come and do that then if you want to do all this stuff. It's hard to do funerals because we were taught, you know, and the people that taught us were born probably in the late 1800s. So them teachings go back a long ways. Anyway, respect the person, how he does the things that he has to do. And the same with the naming ceremony. You give him tobacco, he comes over, and we have food. If it's a small child, you know, we have food. We put a mat on the floor there, and we put a dish out for each of one of the namesakes or wans, put a pipe full of tobacco by each plate, and then the man will take the child, and he'll start talking in Ojibwe, how he got this gift of naming. You have to explain that to the people. And he might tell you of a dream he had or some spiritual happening that happened to him in his early years. And he has to talk for that. And gifts are important. When you ask somebody to come over, you have to have your offering there. Now, those offerings are not for him personally. He's got to offer those when he talks. He's got to offer them to the spirits as he's talking about. That's why you have these gifts there. At the end of the ceremony, he may take his gifts and take them home. He might keep one or two gifts and give the rest out because they were meant to be, you know, offered. Of course, nowadays, money, you couldn't get around without money. So, you know, and money is a good thing to have. I mean, we've got hundreds of miles to do a funeral, let's say, and people might have given us $20 or $50 or something, you know. And, you know, that doesn't cover the gas. So people have to learn to be a little more generous and give the amount how important they think a ceremony is. You know, like a naming ceremony. I've gotten a lot of gifts. I've gotten a lot of cash sometimes, and not a lot, I would say $20 or $50, you know. But the gifts, you know, and that's good. Sometimes haven't gotten anything.
Mm-hmm.
Pack of cigarettes and that's it. And
so you say money is good, because I think sometimes Anishinaabe people, there's this kind of, I don't know if you want to call it that, you know, money is bad in these kind of contexts.
Yeah, money is not bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if Eric, if you had to go 130 miles round trip to do a naming ceremony and you're broke, you're an elder, you're broke,
mm-hmm.
go over there and they give you $10, what are you going to do? You have gifts. You can't stick them in your gas tank. You have tobacco. You use that for prayers. You can't stick the rest in your gas tank, you know.
Yep.
So the people should know. And you know, we can't charge. You know, a lot of times I get asked to go do a naming ceremony or get asked to go do a funeral. And I say, how much do you want? How much you charge? Well, I don't charge.
There's no hourly rate.
Right, but keep in mind, I'm coming 120 miles one way to come and do this, and I have my assistant, you know. So just keep that in mind. I mean, I've heard of people charging, you know, and that's not the way to do it. Otherwise, if we do that, we lose our gifts, you know. We don't do this for money. We do this to help our fellow Anishinaabe. Kids Anishinaabe, we do kawanan, gawin, gada, winda, mawasawanan. So whatever you feel you can give is what you give. You know, however important you think your name is, however important you think that person is, to give that person a send-off in a proper manner.
You mentioned naming ceremonies and you mentioned funerals. What are some of the other, like, I guess, in between those two life milestones that especially our young Anishinaabe parents out there should kind of be mindful of as they're bringing their children up?
Well, they have a lot of memorial feasts. We don't feast just once a year. And sometimes we do it two or three times during the year. when we think of our people that have gone on, we remember them. And, oh, well, let's set a dish out tonight and have somebody come over and talk. So you go give them tobacco and say, I want you to talk for this feast that we're going to have. It's in memory of our late father or whatever. And they do that kind of things. Their feast they have before they go hunting in the fall of the year. They'll put on a feast for that and thanking the Creator for, you know, a good season that they're going to have and for safety. So they have feasts for that. There might be somebody that's seriously ill. They will put on a feast for that, asking the Creator for some help.
Mm-hmm.
There are all kinds of feasts that Indians do. And we are so spiritual. I mean, you know, we pray for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we pray, too, we don't only pray for ourselves. We pray for everybody. I know when I do the prayers at a big drum ceremony, I pray for everybody's health. I pray that everybody's prayers be answered, that put their tobacco offering in there. I pray to the soldiers that are fighting overseas. I pray to the people that are incarcerated, people that are in hospitals, nursing homes, people that are just out and about and are not able to get to a ceremony. I pray for all those. You know, they need help too. They need support.
For younger parents, talk a little bit about the importance of these first kill ceremonies when a young person goes out and kills something for the first time, deer.
Yeah, when fishing. Used to be when they'd first kill a deer, these young guys, whether 10, 12, 13 or whatever, they would put on a big feast for that. He's showing people that he can provide as a provider in the community there. So what they do is they prepare a big feast out of that fresh kill. They feed all the elders. They have all the elders come over, and that's where he gives thanks, and he's recognized as a hunter. You know, and then he gives the rest of his meat to his elders.
Mm-hmm.
Then he can go out and kill deer, and he can hoard it for his family or whatever.
Hoard it.
and the same with fish, too. Anything you take, you share with the elders.
Mm-hmm.
Elders are very important to Shinabe people. They're the ones that supposedly, supposedly because they call me an elder now, know many things. Well, I don't look at myself as one of those people. But I grew up with elders, listening to elders, and then also with the elders, that them being elders, they hung around with nothing but other elders. So I got ears full, years of ears, you know, just, man, it's crammed into me.
This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunida, a program of Ojibwe culture, which is brought to you in part by the University of Minnesota Duluth Department of American Indian Studies, home of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance, or MTAG program, where students learn about leadership, law, sovereignty, and management from a tribal perspective. MTAG was designed by tribes for tribes, accepting applications for fall 2014 semester now through August. More information at umdmtag.org. Our guest today is Larry Mick Smallwood, a language instructor at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He is the Director of Language and Culture for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe and is also a contributing voice to the Ojibwe People's Dictionary, an online resource created by the University of Minnesota. I want to ask you a little bit about the environment you grew up in at Ajimug and why you think that particular place was maybe a little different from other Ojibwe communities at that time.
Well, as people were migrating from the east, you know, they came through upper Wisconsin and down a little south a little ways and into Minnesota. And, you know, as people grew older and families found areas they liked, they stopped and settled down. The other ones were still exploring, going westward, you know. And then when they started organizing and using boundaries, I think that's why Minnesota and Wisconsin there, like I grew up on the Wisconsin border on the Minnesota side, Minnesota-Wisconsin border on the Minnesota side, and a lot of our people kept heading west. When the boundaries came in, you know, just everybody on this side of St. Croix River will be Mille Lacs, you know, up to, you know, so hey, it's a government thing.
And yeah, the community there is what, about a good hour and a half drive to Mille Lacs? Or?
Well, they call it Lake Lena, but it's wrongfully called Lake Lena. It should be called Stevens Lake after one of our chiefs there. And the Stevens Lake community called Ajumug should be called Stevens Lake, after one of our chiefs. That is about an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes to Mille Lacs. And so we're all Mille Lacs, all the way up to the Big Lake, and a little north of there, Lake McGregor. So we're all Mille Lacs people. And because of that boundary, St. Croix River, the Wisconsin people came to St. Croix tribe out that way, all the way up to Brainerd is where we go. It's kind of it's spaced out. I mean, the main part of Mille Lacs being over Mille Lacs Lake, then we got our 100 miles east, we have Stevens Lake, and then 50 miles north, we have East Lake and Sandy Lake, and then we have Isle and so on.
And then as far as your community, was there a leader during the treaty time that you know of that signed some of those treaties? Or
first one I knew about would have been a gentleman by the name of Jim Stevens. Before that, see, Buffalo's got some their descendants down there in Oshawagon all over the place. So it comes back from the old Madeline Island days.
One thing I wanted to ask you about today is your thoughts about sweat lodges. And sweat lodge, I think, is something that for Ojibwe people and all kinds of Native people and non-Natives, too, it's something they're familiar with as far as, you know, Native spirituality. I wonder if you could talk about the role of a sweat lodge when you were growing up and maybe how that's different from today.
You know, when I grew up, I watched my people sweat, the elders sweat. They had their individual little sweat lodges outside sometimes. And I used to watch my dad. He would have a sweat right inside the house. He would heat up his stones inside the stove, his rocks, and he would make a little covering inside his, right in the living room there. He would cover that up and he would crawl in there and he would sweat by himself. Individual sweats, you know, and sometimes... But sometime later, after I moved to the cities, I started hearing people going to sweats, and there were like 10, 15 guys going in a sweat, you know, and some of them, women have sweats, and some of people have co-ed sweats, and I'm not sure, you know, if there's a right or wrong way, you know, I don't know that much about it. I know my partner over here has sweats down by his house, co-ed sweats. You go to another place, it was only men only, and another place that women only. So, but the purpose of a sweat is to go in there and purify your body and your mind. Mm-hmm. You go in there and you pray. You pray for everybody. You pray, and it's hot. It's really hot in there. Everybody takes turns praying. I know my uncle told me one time, somebody asked me if I could do a sweat. And I said, no, I haven't been given the permission yet. So I was talking to my uncle one time, and I was telling him that. He said, yeah, I give you permission right now to run a sweat. He said, you know the language, you can run a sweat. And I said, no, okay, but I've yet to run one. And he told me, he said, if you get people in that sweat, and you hear each one of them praying, he said, and if they pray in English or another language, he said, all you have to do is talk in your language and pray that everybody's prayers in there be answered. Okay? And that's your job in there to hold that. Hmm. I said, oh, okay. So if I ever do, that's what I'll do, is I'll pray for everybody that's in there, you know. But it's hot. It gets really hot. Some people go all the way through the four doors, and some of them last one door. Depends. In order to go to a sweat, you should find somebody that's been given the right to hold a sweat. There are certain individuals that have been given that right to hold a sweat. Okay? I know a couple of guys back here in the 80s, they said they were going to somebody's sweat, and me, back in my mind, I said, I wonder when he started doing these sweats. You know, I don't know, he doesn't speak the language. So anyway, some guys came back the next day. Man, their legs were all blistered and burnt, you know, and don't know what happened there. Oh, so I know what happened, you know. He shouldn't have been in there, or he shouldn't have been doing a sweat. You take that guy down south here, Arizona, this guy made a 50 feet across sweat there with plastic discs and all kinds of weird tarps and charging people money to go in there and people going in there that shouldn't have been in there. And, well, look what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, you go fooling around with something spiritual that was given to an Anishinaabe, you don't have any business going in there. nor does he have any business charging money for people to go in there, and they get punished. I heard a guy from Panama one time saying, and I liked his words, he said, and I said, oh, he said, if you do things wrong, the Creator's going to spank you. I like that word. Yes, he was good. Yeah, so if you want to go to a sweat, you know, find somebody that can properly hold one, you know, not just anybody can have one. Some people go in there for the wrong reasons. You go in there to purify your mind and your body and pray for people.
Was it different, though, why people went in, like, when you were growing up, why people would do that, just their individual kind of sweat that they do? Was it more for, like, hunting and things like that? Or?
No, it was just more for they weren't feeling good, you know, and you know, they were having something was bothering them. They would go into a sweat. They didn't need a whole bunch of people over there. They just went in there themselves and did a sweat. But in the 70s and late 70s, that's when I noticed people were cramming into these sweat lodges. I'm not saying that's wrong. Might be another tribe's way, you know, that's good. But you know.
Well, let me ask you this. Would you personally go into, like, a sweat lodge that was co-ed?
You know, I haven't been in a sweat lodge since 1992. I guess it depends on who's holding it, you know. And then I would go in. But I don't think I've had the need or desire to go into a sweat lodge.
Because some people are funny about that. They say you should never go into a co-ed one.
Right.
Because, you know, if you're a man.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I just know there were some for men only and some for women only and some have co-ed.
Yep.
You know,
like, so it's really the person you're saying.
Yeah.
Just you like know, everything else.
It is.
Yeah. You know.
So anyway, yeah, I haven't been in one since 92. And the man I went in the sweat with back then, his name was Jimmy Jackson. And, of course, I traveled around with him for just a short spell there for a couple of years and learned a lot from him. There used to be a lot of medicine men back then in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that could speak fluently really good. You know, I always wind up speaking about that language, you know, language is so important. I take a lot of convincing.
Well, and it gets back to all the stuff we've been talking about because, I mean, it's, you know, whether it's sweat lodge or some of these ceremonies that people are offering tobacco and want to have, really the first thing you should do is make sure that the person, I mean, language is the key to all of that stuff.
Right. Just like our midday ceremonies, you know, people go through there, and that's good. You know, a lot of people are going through. That's good if they're going through for the right reason. You know, it's a healing ceremony. You go in there, you have a problem or problems. You go in there, and you know, and you get healed. You get spiritual help that way. Some of the people are going just to go and say they've been through there. You know, and that's the wrong reason. I know for a fact that it helps people, you know, that want to get help, that go in there for the right reason.
So something like that, I mean, what would be your advice there? If someone has the desire to do that, should they approach an elder and start talking to them about it before they kind of hop in and make sure they're doing that for the right reason? Or,
well, if they have an illness or something, they should find out who does those ceremonies and then go talk to them. They can give them the advice. I can't give that advice.
Right.
You know, it's not my, how do I say it? Going in, give me any goes, I say, no. The day we weigh on, but going in, can I see, no. I'm way up a car, dies a chicken, we need, okay, can't. Yeah, there's people around that do those ceremonies that are knowledgeable in that. And the preparation is long. I mean, you have to have a lot of blankets and a lot of gifts and stuff to give, you know.
Yeah. So. But I think, you know, that kind of ties into what we were talking about, sweat lodges, too, to a certain extent, because I think what you see happening in our communities is that people, you know, that didn't grow up necessarily in traditional families, they want to get, you know, they want to do things that, you know, traditional way as adults, which is, I think is a good thing, but I think they kind of look at it, at things like Sweat Lodge or even like going to Midday, as like, this is something you have to do, to be a traditional person almost. And do you think that's...
You know, maybe to them they have to find their identity
because
they didn't grow up with it. But I'm talking about the midday ceremony. If you have a problem, a health problem, then by all means, that's where you go.
Right.
But yeah, I think a lot of them are finding their... They're looking for their identity. They're finding it. And it makes them feel good.
So you have a theory about that. I think for some people, they think, well, Christians go to church, so if I want to follow Ojibwe ways, I have to go to Sweat Lodge or I need to go through Midé, not really realizing that there are other aspects to it.
Well, these are things that were given to us. So that's the best I can answer that.
And it's not necessarily something that's a rite of passage necessarily, right? I mean, it's again, it's something you go in for specific reasons.
The most important thing, though, is getting your name. You know, you're getting back.
That is a standard thing, right? That we should all be doing.
Yes.
And language, too, from what we've heard over these sessions, too, right? I mean,
to me,
I think a lot of people, you know, they want to follow traditional ways, but, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, probably the first thing they should do is learn language, right?
Exactly. The first thing that they should do in anything is learn the language, you know? That's what I've been saying all this time, but yet they want to go out and do things, you know, not knowing the language. So you can't do those things. Language is first. Whatever you do, want to give a name, want to hold a sweat, want to do a feast, all that stuff, you have to know your language.
That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our guest, Larry Mick Smallwood, for sharing his stories with us. This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunida, and I'm your host, Eric Reddix. To listen again to past episodes of Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunida, visit the KUMD website at kumd.org and click on Audio Archives. Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunida is produced by KUMD and the Department of American Indian Studies at UMD, with funding provided in part by the College of Education and Human Service Professions and by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.